Welcome to the Wags of SCI podcast, where we discuss life, love, and caregiving after spinal cord injury. Hosted by Elena Pauly and Brooke Paget. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Wags of SCI podcast with your hosts, Brooke Paget and Elena Pauly.
Hello, hello. Today we have an incredible guest whose time we are so honored to be able to share with you today. Her name is Eve Rodsky. She is the New York Times bestselling author of Fair Play. Fair Play is a game-changing solution for when you have too much to do and more life to live. She received her BA in economics and anthropology from the University of Michigan and her JD from Harvard Law School. After working in foundation management at JP Morgan, she founded Philanthropy Advisory Group to advise high net worth families and charitable foundations on best practices for harmonious operations, governance, and disposition of funds. In her work with hundreds of families over a decade, she realized that her expertise in family mediation strategy and organizational management could be applied to a problem closer to home, a system for couples seeking balance, efficiency, and peace in their homes. Rodsky was born and raised by a single mom in New York City and now lives in Los Angeles with her husband and three children. So welcome today, Eve.
So nice to be here with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. When we learned about you from another WAG, we were super excited because we are all about creating balance in our situation. It's very, very difficult for a lot of women who are in a, we'll call it interabled relationship with someone who has a spinal cord injury. And they also have, you know, stuff to do in the household. The list never seems to end. And we're always seeking that balance that can be sometimes impossible to find, especially when you're under stress. So we're super excited to chat with you today.
I'm so happy to be here. I'm just, as I was saying to you earlier, I have data for interabled couples. About 10% of my research were from people who identified as having differently abled circumstances in some way. So I'm excited for the conversation today.
That's amazing. Awesome. So if to kind of start off, let's pretend that nobody here knows anything about you or the work you have done. So could you please sort of explain to our audience your background, how you became interested in your work and championing for women's domestic rights? And like Brooke said earlier, it's such a delicate balance as our partner's physical bodies have been mostly, you know, a jeopardy or taken away for some extent. So how did you get into this and why is this important and why is it important to have equality and self-care in the home and in the workforce for women?
Well, especially for women, right, who have extra labor to think about and to handle, it's extra important because it's literally life or death for us. It's our mental health, our physical health, as we've been seeing in the pandemic. But I didn't know these things were happening to me at all, right? Elena and Brooke, this was not my life's dream to become a gender division of labor activist, right? That wasn't something I had in my third grade. What do you want to be when you grow up form? I think I had like astronaut there or something. until I realized you had to actually go into space and I was too scared. But
fair enough.
Yes, but it was for me, it was literally they call research me-search. I had a complete breakdown, of my marriage and my mental health and my identity around my second son being born. And I read about it in Fair Play. Ironically, it started with a text my husband Seth sent me that said, "I'm surprised you didn't get blueberries." And that text was a day. I don't get to write exactly the scene, so we can all picture the scene, right? So I'm texting and driving in my car. I'm getting a text from my husband, Seth. "I'm surprised you didn't get blueberries." I have a breast pump and a diaper bag in the passenger seat of my car. I have gifts for a newborn baby to return in the back seat of my car. I also had a three-year-old at the time besides a newborn baby. So I was racing in that car to go pick him up from his toddler transition program, which in America, those last 7 minutes and they cost our entire salaries. I had been forced out of the traditional workforce. I never use the term opted out anymore, because if you are a woman and you have left the traditional workforce and you intended to stay, most likely, actually, let's say 100% likely, you were forced out of that traditional workforce. So I was forced out of the traditional workforce. I started my own law firm. I had a client contract in my lap. Every time I would mark up the contract at a stop sign, the pen would sort of like stab me in the vagina. And in that chaos of the day, I pulled over. I pulled over and I started to cry on the side of the road. And we don't take that lightly in Los Angeles. That's where I live now. So for me to pull over and to be late to pick up Zach was a very big deal. And I remember thinking that day, why was I so triggered by this text? And I think I was feeling the reality that I did not have the career marriage combo I thought I was going to have. I was just on a panel with this amazing fiction writer. She wrote a book called Night Bitch about a woman who became a stay-at-home mom, or I call it in Fair Play, an accidental traditionalist. It wasn't what she intended, but that's just how her life circumstances happened. And she starts turning into a dog. And so when we were on this call together, we were both talking about the fact that when you don't have intentional choices in your life, right? When things just happen, it makes you feel like you're going to lose agency, which also can make you feel like you're going to lose your mind. And that's sort of where I was that day, thinking not only do I not have the career marriage combo I thought I was going to have, but I was living a statistic, 2/3 or more of what it takes to run a home and family. This is without inter-able issues. 2/3 or more of what it takes to run a home and family falls on women. And that was the statistic I was undeniably living that day, but I didn't even know about. And so that day, the day that I decided I was no longer going to be defined as the fulfiller of my husband's smoothie needs, was a day I started to become much more aware of what was going on around me and behind me for the past 100 years. And then ultimately 10 years later, it led to research for thousands and thousands of people, tens of thousands of people who are playing Fair Play and who believe that society should not be built on the unpaid labor of women. And that's where we are today. We're just starting a big, big cultural and political movement that I hope all of your listeners will join us in some way.
Oh my God, absolutely. Are you kidding me? This is totally up our alley. Brooke and I both have been really advocating with our last article in the Washington Post that basically stated full-time job, no pay. And this is exactly our forte and what we so deeply believe in. It's sort of like our bread and butter and our big passion project. And we know that together we can definitely do amazing work together for all of our listeners. Please, please stay listening to what Eve has to say here, because there's going to be some really great content and some great tips that are, you know, their lived experience and they actually work.
And Eve, I love how open and honest you are about your story, about like how you were like literally like unstable, literally having a bit of a breakdown and existential crisis. And how I feel like there's a lot of shame surrounding that in the Western model of society, where you have to maintain this image of everything's fine on the outside, even when you have these breakdowns. And, you know, in my belief, a lot of the most amazing life transitions come from that moment of existential crisis where you're like, I literally cannot do this anymore as I'm doing it. And I feel like people don't talk about that. And this has been happening a lot during the COVID-19 pandemic, mm-hmm. and still nobody is really talking about it. And so I'm really, really glad that you brought that up, because I know there's a lot of our followers that will really, really be able to relate to this. My question is, what followed that immediately? Like, what steps did you take when you kind of had your like big realization? Did you feel like everything was super chaotic at first and you kind of had to like reestablish yourself in who you wanted to be? And did you have any pushback from yourself or your husband when it came to kind of like how you wanted to live now?
Well, that's such a great question, because I think it's important to reflect on the privilege I had. I had two important things that would allow me to have conversations that maybe other people wouldn't feel comfortable having. One, I've always had a lens towards, even though gender division of labor specialist was not in my third grade, what I want to be when I grow up, I always had an orientation to these issues because I grew up in a single parent household on Avenue C and 14th Street, New York City. And I saw firsthand how hard it was, really hard it was for my mother to do it all. In fact, you know, I have a disabled brother who nobody really even knew he couldn't read until he was almost in high school. And I had to be the one to tell my parents. I wrote them a letter about that. I was a parental child. I was helping my mother with eviction notices as early as 7 years old. I can remember circling our free World Wildlife Foundation calendar with a big circle on the first of the month telling her it's time to pay our rent. And so it was very much in my mindset that I was going to marry an equal partner and shape my life that way. And then on top of that, as you so nicely said earlier in my intro, I'm a Harvard trained mediator. I'm actually trained in difficult conversations. I'm a lawyer. I'm a mediator. That's what I do for a living. I work for families like the HBO show Succession. And I structure their family foundations and their family businesses. And you should all feel bad for me out there. But what I do for those families is I have difficult conversations with them over who makes decisions. And so if I couldn't have these conversations after the lens of what I went through, plus the fact that I'm trained in difficult conversations. And instead, as you said, I found myself alone in my car crying by myself in shame that my marriage was ending over off-season blueberries, then I figured this must be happening to other women. And I guess the good news for fair play, right, but the bad news for society, and that's being sarcastic, is that it was happening to all women in 17 countries. It was happening to the least privileged of women, as again, like my single mother, Black women in America who are single mothers, all the way up to the 1%. This issue of unpaid labor is a gating issue for the world. $1.9 trillion of unpaid labor is done every single year. But for me, the last thing I will say in this question is that I think it was really important to recognize that it wasn't just a me problem. And there's a sociologist at the turn of the century named C. Wright Mills who said private lives are public issues. And that was really important to me, that I don't leave a world behind me where anybody believes that this is happening to them alone, that their circumstances are theirs alone. And Brooke and Elena, that's why I found you and wanted to join you, because you do that so beautifully together. You've created a community to say you don't have to be alone in these really, really difficult issues of life and child rearing. So the last piece of this question was, how did I realize it wasn't just a me problem? Well, right after the blueberries day, when I was becoming more aware of these issues, and I read about this again in Fair Play, that I was on a breast cancer march with 9 of my closest friends. And these are very powerful women. They're CEOs of nonprofits, an Oscar-winning producer, just really beautiful, strong women who use their voices in every aspect of their lives. And we had this Saturday morning, which was this true girlfriend's getaway. It was a beautiful morning, honoring our friend, marching together, wearing all pink. But at noon, we all became the reverse of Cinderella. Like, we just turned into pumpkins. We began getting inundated with texts and phone calls from our partners with things like, when is the babysitter coming? I'm done watching the babysitting my own kids. Where's Hudson's soccer bag? What's the address of the birthday party? And did you leave me a gift? My favorite was my friend Kate's husband, and his text was, do the kids need to eat lunch? And I think it was that day, the fact that those women didn't turn off their phones and say, okay, let's go to lunch, but that every single one of those women said to me, we left our partners with too much to do. And they ran off. They left me there. But before they left, I said, I need you to help me count up how many phone calls and texts we've received. And we had 30 phone calls and 46 texts for 10 women over 30 minutes. And wow. I think that was the day that I realized I'm not going to let anybody live like this anymore.
Wow.
Wow.
I love that you put it so eloquently that you were able to sort of take that outsider perspective and just sort of look with it and say, holy shit, this is happening. And why is this happening, right? That's a big question. It's like, why is this happening? Why have we, I guess, society kind of conditioned us to, you know, women sort of play their role within the partnership of, you know, women are sort of to be there to provide all these needs, to look perfect, to never show any sort of emotional neglect that they might need themselves. And, you know, the caregiving of themselves before their own partners has been so deeply forgotten, especially within our community. And I love how Brooke and I always say this quite often. We say that, you know, motherhood and caregiving, from our standpoint of WEGs of SCI, caregiving for your partner with disabilities, there are so many intersections between the two that it's kind of hard to pull them apart, you know, especially when your partner becomes disabled and has a spinal cord injury and loses all their physical ability to be able to do not only half of the domestic chores, but even care for themselves. So how would you, what is your perspective of how do you see the two sort of correlating?
Well, it's a good question. And I actually never get to really talk about this, but around the same time of the blueberries and the breast cancer march, I call her my sister, but she's my first cousin. And I grew up in her household because my mother, as I said earlier, was a single mother. So her sister took me everywhere with her daughters. So my cousin's my closest relative. We have two boys the same age. But she, this is 2013. She had a partner. So I was sort of breaking down in my marriage over, Seth believing that I was, you know, in charge of literally every single domestic task for our family. I called myself the default parent, but really it's the she-fault parent. And, this can apply to LGBTQIA couples as well, but it is a woman's role. This happens to women primarily. So, but at the same time, my cousin's husband there, he was going out for a run. And he collapsed on their kitchen floor with a catastrophic stroke. He had a grade 5 AVM. He was in the hospital for 9 weeks. I flew out. I live with my cousin for a lot of that time. What was interesting about her partnership was that he was a man. Ironically, that is very similar to the, I call them more than most in my book, but he was a man that was holding a lot of the unpaid labor of their home. There were two lawyers. And so when he went into the ICU, my cousin is subsequently has been on, you know, an 8-year journey, and ultimately it led to the dissolution of their marriage. But, I got to watch a man who, what it looked like to be in a partnership where there was somebody, a partner who was able to do, their fair share of domestic labor, to one where my cousin was his caretaker as well as the parent of their two children. And the toll that it took on her in a couple ways was really alarming. Number one was she worked for an organization, a highly sexist organization that would give her no paid leave, zero paid leave, and then penalized her, did not promote her, because she was working from home on Fridays, even though I would argue she's working harder and more efficient while trying to take care of Brad. She was completely devalued by the hospital system, where she was shamed and guilted for asking about in-home care and insurance to get caretaking and help. She was assumed, it was assumed that she would have to catheterize her husband and move him from place to place, even though she's a really small person and couldn't do that. Her insurance, even though it was some of the best, couldn't get her the in-home care that she wanted. So it then put a toll on her father and her mother to help them, and his parents. And so I watched the entire community not rally around them, but also the toll it was taking on her career, her mental health, her physical health, because literally nobody in their community, her workplace, the medical system, nobody around her was able to say, we value your caregiving. We believe you should be paid for it. We believe that it's hard. We believe that you should have a social safety net in America that allows you to do this with some grace and dignity and time for yourself. And so that's when these issues started emerging for me. The fact that unpaid labor is such an important issue because the home is so dangerous. It's so dangerous because you think that, you know, you're divorcing over off-season blueberries, or you're in total guilt and shame over the fact that you don't want to tell people that your marriage is falling apart because of a transition in caregiving. It's so dangerous because you think it's individual when really everybody has these issues. And of course, I'm not saying that, you know, inter-abled couples don't have it harder. Of course, the daily grinds are grindier. You have all the issues I just talked about that happened to my cousin and more. But what I realized was that if we all could come together as care feminists and recognize that the last frontier of feminism is ironically in the place closest to us, our homes, then we would have a safety net for people who get into situations where life happens to them, and we ignore and try to sweep under the rug that we do not have the any sort of soft landing for when those things happen, when those wild cards happen.
Well, we always talk about this. Thank you for sharing all of that. It's just, it's amazing. We're so lucky to be able to talk to you. We talk about a lot in our community how people just don't, caregivers and the caregiving life applies to everybody. We always share that quote, you know, about how everybody will either be a caregiver, need a caregiver, or, you know a caregiver or have to use a caregiver. That's not the exact quote, but there's a quote out there that we always talk about, and how it just applies to every single person. But for whatever reason, that awareness of the struggles that everybody, it'll apply to everybody eventually. People don't want to look at it, because if they look at it, they can't unsee it. And if they can't unsee it, then they have to do something about it. And that's where, you know, this whole awareness piece comes in is, you know, we're WAGs of SCI. We're people that have partners with spinal cord injuries, but these issues apply to every single person and will apply to every single person. And for somebody like a friend, an able-bodied couple that I know, you know, for a woman in that relationship to think that this won't apply to her and that it doesn't matter to her, it's just such a mistake. So I'm really glad that you brought that up, because this is something that literally applies to every single woman and every single couple on the planet, I would say, right?
On the planet. And that's, you know, and again, I think that there is some solace in that, to say that by being siloed, by having all of these conversations, again, in this sort of this dangerous place of the home, meaning that we're not allowed to talk about these issues. Again, I watched with my cousin the shame and the shingles and the cold sore she got, and her body sort of basically falling apart on her more, she said, not just from the physical caretaking responsibilities, but from the shame and wanting to leave her situation, that nobody would talk about her, that her community would shame her, that the expectations that she would stay with Brad forever and be his caregiver forever was something that really only women have those expectations on us. And so again, it doesn't mean that choice, of course, is for everybody or anybody, but it's just to recognize that even in a situation where you're a caregiver, you're allowed to have agency in your own life. You're allowed to make your own choices. And so I think that's the power to say, we empower you. We're here for you to make the choices that are best for you. And you don't lose that agency just because a caregiving role has been thrust upon you. But society would like for you to think that way, because it's in the convenience of society to not pay people to be caregivers. That has been the dirty secret of our country that we expect. And I think, you know, your op-ed, there's been such beautiful writing lately around, why is it that when I can get insurance for being, you know, for a caregiver for my partner. But then when, you know, there's, when it's a wife and I want to be reimbursed for it, people are like, no, I'm not going to pay you for taking care of your partner. Right. It's just a very strange expectation that we don't look at, this work is important. And so what I'm here to say is that no matter what your situation is, this world will be a better place if we can recognize that an hour holding our child's hand at the pediatrician's office is really, really just as valuable as an hour in the boardroom.
Yeah.
And that's going to take all of us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So to get a little bit into your book, Fair Play, this book is amazing. There, you know, you do such a beautiful job in outlining, you know, the systems for advocacy. Can you share a little bit about your book that you've written?
Absolutely. Let's go solutions, which is more fun than
sure.
Learning. So what I like to say is that I think there really is a secret formula for sort of thriving in a fair relationship, regardless of circumstance. And that is what I like to call boundaries, systems, and communication. If you get those three things right most of the time, you're in really good shape. And so we'll talk about systems and communication. That's where things you can adopt today that we can just move on. But I do want to pause on boundaries for a little bit, because especially, you know, listening, Brooke and Elena, to your stories and to your community, boundaries is a really interesting question. And I will ask you this question because I've asked it now to 750 people specifically for my second book, which is called Find Your Unicorn Space. And I've asked it to thousands of others in the context of Fair Play. But I want to know from both of you, do you believe and maybe it's changed over time, but I want to know if you believe that you deserve a permission to be unavailable from your roles as a parent, a partner, and a professional. Do you believe that you deserve permission to be unavailable from those roles?
I guess I'll start. I honestly feel like there has to be some sort of a serious disconnect in order to really relax. Like, when I'm taking a break or doing something for myself, like even going on a walk or, you know, going to yoga or going to the gym or whatever I'm doing, you always have your phone on you, and it's not necessarily a break, especially when you don't have the resources to make sure that your partner is being taken care of while you're away and you're kind of unsure about that. So, like, I would say, of course, yes, you definitely deserve to have that boundary. But with us, it's so complicated because we don't rarely get a clean break where it's like, I have nothing to worry about in the background of my self-care. Do you understand what I'm saying? There's always that, like,
absolutely. That's why I'm asking.
Concern, right?
Awesome. Yes. Yes.
But I do definitely believe that everybody deserves that.
Elena, yeah. How are you?
Absolutely. I think sort of kind of echoing what Brooke said, that makes a lot of sense. For my personal life, for us, it was very, really quite important for us to set up a system where we did have in-home care, even if it was just for a little bit. And we have a system where if I want to go off with my girlfriends for the weekend, that's just what I do. And you know, been really, really thankful for that, to be able to say, hey, not right now, I'm not available. But I do find that I have to physically remove myself from the household in order for that to happen. And for us specifically, some of the biggest challenges and biggest lessons have been learned that way, for my partner to adapt and do things on his own and see what he's capable of doing and not capable of doing. That is sort of where that stems from, is those really hard moments of, I used to tell Brooke all the time, I'm practicing distancing myself. I'm practicing disconnecting. And it was very uncomfortable at first. I could feel it in my body, in my heart. It was very, very uneasy. I felt, like Burke had basically said, I felt worried. What if something happens? What if I'm not there? And even while I'm in the house, it's like that all the time too. I'm always like, what's wrong? What can I help you with? What is it? You're sort of always on guard. You're always sort of thinking, at any moment, if I sit down, I'm going to have to jump back up. So your mind, it's very difficult for me within my household for my mind just to sort of relax. If I'm reading a book, I'm always thinking about, okay, I should probably get up and do laundry, or I need to go meal prep, or I should go grocery shopping, or I should sweep the floor, like little things like that. Like, do I really need to sweep the floor right now? In my head, I'm like, yes, I need to go Windex or something, you know? So,
but Elena, what about the, like, explain to her the reliance on care and how it's so, you have care come in. You yes. have care come in, and even if you have care, the system still relies on the partner to come in when, you know, Elena, you explained
absolutely.
It.
Yeah. So especially with the transition, Dan and I recently moved to a new area of Vancouver. And that means that our district changed for in-house care. And my partner actually just underwent a nerve transfer surgery to be able to hopefully regain a bit more mobility and dexterity in his hands. And it's been quite the journey where he's required a lot more assistance than what we've ever been provided. And a lot of the time, to be quite honest, you know, we'll be in bed, let's say, and care is coming, supposed to come at 7 o'clock in the morning. My partner also goes to university, which is about an hour commute on the SkyTrain one way. And so he has to be in his course. He's got to be in his class for 9:30. It's 7 o'clock. No care shows up. And then when we call and we ask what's going on, oh, sorry, we couldn't make it today. So there's a lot of that where I have to consistently fill in, because there's no phone call that's even given to us. Nobody's calling us to tell us that they're not going to make it. It's us at maybe 7:05, 7:10, wondering where the hell is everybody? What's going on? So at that point, and it's part of the conditioning through the caregiving of many, many wives and girlfriends in our community, that we just sort of say, you know what? Fuck it. I'll just do it. And that happens quite often.
Mm-hmm. And how does your heart feel like when you hear, I'm not going to make it today?
Well, I think you can sort of sense the frustration in my voice, even sort of recounting these.
Yeah, well, I'm starting to get my heart's pounding, right? I mean, like, even again, yeah. During the pandemic, when my caregiving couldn't come, you know, mm-hmm. my support system for my kids, you know, I feel that cortisol. I think the reason why I ask about boundaries is because we have to be able to shut the cortisol off from our stress systems, right? We have to, right? Because that erodes us over time. And it can't be to that place where, again, I use my cousin's example just because we were so intertwined, where she would say to me, like, I just want, you know, she'd be driving to the hospital, to the ICU. And she's like, you know, sometimes I dream that I'll, you know, veer off the side of the road and get into a car accident, like, not to kill myself, but so that I can go to the hospital and just sleep for 2 days, you know,
right. And just be unavailable. Right.
That's it. Right. And we're like, literally, if I get into a car accident, my kids can't, I don't have guilt and shame because I'm in the hospital, you know?
Well, and that's the thing, is also we rely on the medical system to tell us when to shut off. Right. We wait
right,
until
well, that's what I was saying. I was like, Jessica, you can't tell me that you're dreaming of getting into a car accident. Like, I'm extremely concerned, you know?
Yeah.
And I think so many women have told me versions of that story. And again, not just interabled couples, but across the spectrum, because we don't have, and again, you know, Canada, you know, you think about it, it's like a haven compared to the U.S. here, where so many people don't even have any insurance. And so they're the idea for care. And I was talking to another caregiver for research, and who's also an acquaintance, and, you know, in the U.S., you know, it was so precarious. And then if there was any issue that care couldn't come for, like, insurance, for liability purposes, her son has a disability and he, like, hits a lot. So they were like, well, no, for, like, liability, we can't come. Right. So there's just so many reasons why care doesn't show up for us, why there isn't that. And also because the paid version is completely undervalued. But I think the beauty of understanding that even when you have care, that's really execution. But, you know, what should I be doing today? A lot of that still falls on the caregiver, right? Here are the meds. Here's how the bed works. This is the schedule for today. All that cognitive labor is where the cortisol sits. Mm-hmm. And so I just want us to all. And so I think while we can't always control the circumstances, what we can control in the boundaries is to recognize that guilt and shame doesn't serve us here. it does not serve us. And so one thing we can do for a boundary is to believe that we have a permission to be unavailable from our roles. You always have that permission, even though it's sometimes hard to do. But as Elena said, it may not be perfect, but you can, you know, try to find that way to practice. I love that you use that word practice. It's a practice to remember that you have that permission to be unavailable. Absolutely. It's not perfect. And if you look at it as a practice, the other thing I like to do is my colleague, Dr. Cheryl Gonzalez-Ziegler, she came up with a great framework of when you're feeling that in your bones or that cortisol or the guilt or the shame, you know, I feel guilty for not putting Anna to bed tonight. Instead, you pause that and you say, I made that decision because I made that choice because, right? I feel guilty because I took a weekend away, even though our care situation isn't perfect. I made that choice because this is an investment in my mental health. So I don't end up in the hospital with with our health system telling me that I've hit my burnout. And so I think that little reframe has been very helpful to me over the years. And so that's the boundaries piece. If we move into the solutions piece, which is really the systems and the communication, which can really help with any relationship, and including, of course, with our partners. But the system, what Fair Play is based on, is it's based on an ownership mindset. It's based on the fact that, as you said earlier, that that you know, just tell me what to do is not a helpful way to interact with your partner. And so that's where my data on interabled couples really comes in, because I would go through Fair Play as a metaphor. It's a card game. There's 100 cards in the system. There are more. You can add your own. You can customize it. But it's really about looking at not just who does what in your home, but building your deck together for why you do what you do. Those conversations for why do you take out garbage? Why do you do dishes? They sound so funny to even say them. But the idea that my aha moment in my life was to recognize that I could leave my husband and my kids, right? I could leave. I could eat, pray, love it. When I was having my blueberries breakdown, I could resign myself to doing everything in my household and continue to lose my identity and my physical and mental health. Or I could have a third option, which was to get my ass in gear and become my own client. And so Elena and Brooke, the most important question I asked in the past 10 years was, in the spirit of my mediation practice, which was, what if we treated our homes as our most important organizations? I know it wouldn't look like the way it does now, right? Where we wait to decide who's taking the dog out when it's about to take a piss on the rug, as one person told me, or we wait to set the table when we're hangry and cranky. In interabled couples, there is more conversation. There is more advanced planning because of all the issues we were just talking about. But there's still not really the respect for the home as an organization with the respect and rigor it deserves, just like a workplace would deserve. And so that question, that recognizing that even my Aunt Marion's Mahjong group had more clearly defined expectations in the home, you know, you don't bring snack twice to that group and you're out, was a very important realization for me, to recognize that what I'd been teaching my clients for 10 years was a version of psychological safety in their organization, was a version of the ownership mindset, that the directly responsible individual, as Apple calls it, the giving someone context, not control, to make a decision. And so, of course, even in interabled couples, right, we want to give the psychological safety to our partner to say, I trust you to make decisions. You are accountable in this relationship, right? That those accountability and trust is the cornerstone of a successful organization. And it needs to be there regardless of the extra caregiving layer.
Yeah, those are great tips just for, and literally, like you said, any relationship, able-bodied, interabled, any relationship. And I love like what you say about putting the responsibility and empowering that person to take ownership and accountability for what they can do to contribute. How would you address an issue of, you know, the male in the household that isn't necessarily used to owning his share of the tasks due to whatever attitude he may have? If he's disabled, you know, maybe he's used to having caregivers do everything for him, and that kind of like shift isn't really something he's comfortable with. Or, you know, in an able-bodied relationship, if they're used to their wife doing everything because I work all day, honey, I come home, and, you know, that kind of old school mentality, what they were demonstrated by their fathers. What tools do you have to navigate that, the kind of like a little bit of that pushback or, you know, reconditioning?
Well, that's really fun because I think let's play a little game if you don't mind. So what I like to say is I love tools as a mediator, as a facilitator. As I was saying before, I work with a lot of older white men who have incredible wealth, who say things to me like I'm not going to die, but then hire me for their succession planning. So that is pretty much a conversation ender. But I found that tools have been really helpful to opening up dialogue. And so I think what I'd like to say is to those people who look at chores and housework as that, I try to explain that it's not chores and housework. And this is our humanity, right? So a little story that always makes me smile is one of my clients of extreme wealth was at a funeral of another, his friends of extreme wealth in Northwest US. And he called me, this was, I think, the end of 2018, early 2019, saying, you know, I was just at a funeral and I was thinking of you. And so I was sort of laughing because I was thinking like, why is it that my client is thinking of me in a funeral? But he said that there was this man had three daughters and this was a packed church and the daughters were all in white and they came up to the podium, of the church and each woman was carrying, a piece of paper and they started to recite one at a time, these like really beautiful Shel Silverstein, Dr. Seuss type poems, rhyming and funny, and people didn't understand what was happening. So one daughter reads a poem, and the second daughter comes up and reads a poem, and the third daughter comes up and reads her silly, fun poem. And then they all come into the microphone and say, those were the poems our father wrote for us as a tooth fairy growing up. And what my client was reacting to was the fact that that was all anybody talked about after the service. This man's poetry, this man's humanity in being the tooth fairy for his daughter, right? Nothing about his monetary worth or the companies he's built. And so I think it's really important to remember that these are things you can both do. Right. You know, being the tooth fairy, leaning into the caregiving, the humanity, the magic of these spaces in between, that the connection we get as human beings are often sometimes what a capitalist patriarchal society will call chores and housework, to undervalue this when this is really, to me, nothing is more valuable than that man's role as the tooth fairy for his daughters.
That's such a beautiful story. That's so awesome. That like gave me chills. And it's just a good reminder that like, you know, we have millennial parents now, right? Millennial parents that are, they've been looked after and babied by their mom their whole life. And now they're in a role where they're trying to live up to these expectations that they create for themselves. They're lost, right? And so they put all their work into what they've been demonstrated, which is work, 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 and let the wife do a lot of the work. And oh, what? The wife doesn't want to do the work because she's been empowered. She's been empowered in this day and age. And what? She doesn't want that. And they're so confused and they're lost. And they're, you know, it's, you see it time and time and time again.
Absolutely. And so that's it. So the way I would say like the beauty of the Fair Play system is it's not a list. Lists don't work. systems do. And what a system does is it brings accountability and trust into a relationship. And so I'll say one more thing about the system before I want to play a game. But what the second most important question I ask, besides what would happen if we treated our homes as our most important organizations, was in 17 countries, I asked, how did mustard get into your refrigerator? And I would often hear an answer for opposite sex couples, even in the most progressive relationships. That's what you're saying, right? Even in the millennial and the older, I guess, Gen Z now, very progressive relationships, I would hear, well, this would be the woman speaking. I noticed my second son, Johnny, likes yellow mustard with his protein. Otherwise he chokes. He won't eat any protein. That's why it's in the refrigerator. So that's a step in organizational management we call conception. And then I would hear, oh, and I monitor the mustard for when it's running low, and I get stakeholder buy-in from my family for what they need all week on the grocery list. I obviously didn't hear stakeholder buy-in, but that's what I'm listening for. That is a phase that's very common called planning. And then I hear, oh yeah, and then I sent my, you know, partner to the store for the yellow mustard, and the dude brought home spicy Dijon, and you want me to trust him with my living will? He can't even bring home the right type of fucking mustard. That was it. And so again, as a mediator, the presenting problem is never the real problem. It's not about mustard or blueberries. This is ultimately about, as we said earlier, accountability and trust. Building a relationship, a system, a family, a unit that has accountability and trust. And so what I saw over and over again was that the lifeline to getting there is communication. It is communication. And I'll tell you one other story again before I want to play this little game with you. It was the pandemic was really interesting. I got, you know, I have tons and tons of data, but early on in my research, this is before the pandemic, I would ask women, especially, how do you communicate about domestic life with your partner? And so many of them said to me, you know, it's too triggering. We don't communicate. And that happened a lot, actually, with interable couples as well. Well, one woman I spoke to said, you know, I can't communicate with my partner. It's too triggering. 20 minutes later, she said to me, you know, every time my partner forgets to put the laundry in the dryer, I dump it on his pillow. And so I crossed out, doesn't communicate about domestic life. And I put in all caps, communicates about domestic life. And I want to be very clear. In the pandemic, there was a 27,000 member Facebook group called The Reasons I Hate My Husband and Kids During COVID. And one woman, I always get alerted to these types of groups for research purposes from all my community now. One woman was in the group and she posted, if my husband dies during COVID, it won't be because of the disease, it'll be because of me. So very provocative language.
I've heard that many, many times, just what right, I say. Right, yeah.
Exactly. So I reach out to her on DM and I say, okay, please, how do you communicate about domestic life? You know, something, obviously you're feeling very riled up here to say that. And she writes me back, thank you for the message. I told her I was a researcher on these issues. We don't communicate about domestic life. This is my safe space. And so I want us all to reflect on the fact that publicly threatening to murder her partner in front of 27,000 strangers felt safer to her than communicating directly with her partner. How do we get to that place? And so reestablishing a lifeline to communication is the way to get to the systems. It doesn't work the other way around. We have to start establishing communication as a practice in our very busy lives, the same way we commit to exercise. We have to practice communication with our partner, and that often means not giving feedback in the moment and setting aside 10 minutes a night to check in. That's what Seth and I do. It took us years to implement that practice, but once we did, we couldn't believe that we had actually functioned without it. And so that communication And so that's what I wanted to stop and say, let's do something fun where if this feels triggering to you, because I just gave you 10 years of learning in less than an hour. So this is a 101, but just remember that the Fair Play cards, you can find them online, fairplaylife.com. You can print them out. We have them on, there are heart decks available everywhere. But you can use them, these really fun ways to start communicating during your check-in or prompts, just starting to tell stories. So let's just practice. I'm going to pull out my deck. I'll start with you, Brooke. So I'm going to pull out my deck and then I'm just going to start shuffling. And then you just tell me stop. And I'm just going to pick a completely random card.
Okay. This is cool. okay. Stop.
Okay. So I stopped on spirituality. So what I want, so again, I just picked one random out of the deck. I stopped on spirituality when you said stop. So Brooke, tell me anything you want to tell me about growing up. Any story you can remember about spirituality in your family growing up?
It doesn't matter if it's like, is it neutral or is it negative, positive or?
Anything. That's what I mean. Anything. The worst, you know, having to go to church and you didn't want to. The best that you had a trip that changed your life. Anything. Anything about spirituality growing up that you remember in the context of your family.
Yeah. So I was pretty much like my mom grew up in a very religious household, very religious Baptist. And she kind of deviated from that into like more of a free Pentecostal style Christianity. And from the time I was little up until I was 14, I was kind of like assumed that I would go to church every Sunday. And I did. And I started to really not like it when I was in my early teens. And then when I was 14, my mom said, you know, you have a choice now. Do you want to come to church or do you want to stay home? And I decided to stay home. And I kind of disconnected from traditional religion then just because of various reasons. And that kind of started me on another journey, which is like, you know, self-actualization. I was very interested in like, you know, Buddhism and different ways of thinking when it came to spirituality, not just religion, not organized religion at all. So yeah.
Well, that's so cool. And I feel like even we just, that was like 25 seconds or 30 seconds, but I already feel like I know you so much better now. And so can you imagine if we had these conversations with our partners where we just started telling our stories? As opposed to looking at this as chores.
And having them actually listen and pay attention.
Oh, that's it, right? We're just going to play this game today where we're just going to tell each other one story. Mm-hmm. You start, that's how you start your, you know, before who does what, you're just going to start learning about each other. Because I bet you, Brooke, oh my God, I'm your partner. Now I know why you get really angry when I tell you I want to take the kids to church, right? I mean, it allows us in a way that we don't have to spend. And again, I'm not saying that psychotherapy isn't incredibly important. It is, but it allows us also to have just tools to converse, to learn about our past that maybe don't always have to happen in the context of these very deeper learnings, which can happen, you know, concurrently. So Elena, can I do one with you?
Yeah, of course. Sorry. I'm just silently laughing in the background right now because, this game is pretty cool. I feel like we've had company over lately. And, the more I tell stories to my company, my partner overhears and he keeps on saying things like, I didn't know that about you. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And we've been together for 9 years. So I'm sort of like laughing in the background about this game.
But that's it. That is it. Why was it that when Seth understood the Fair Play system that he was going to own garbage and he really understood it. He understood that that meant putting the freaking garbage liner back in, right? And getting the little garbages around the house. But why was I still his garbage shadow? Mm. Why? That's what Fair Play is about. The system is the onboarding, the ability for me to tell stories to him to say, you know what? We've been together over 10 years and you know what? You don't actually know this about me, but I didn't have a garbage can growing up. For me, garbage was just a takeout bag on a knob in my kitchen, and it would spill out onto the floor. And when my disabled brother would ask me for water, because I would put him to bed at night as a latchkey kid, because my mother worked nights, I'd have to close my eyes and count to 10 so the cockroaches and water bugs would scatter before I could walk into the kitchen to our Brita filter, which I remember was like the most expensive thing we ever got. And I was so happy to get a Brita filter. But it was when I see a garbage bag or a banana peel spilling out over garbage, I'm triggered to remember what it felt like to live in that house, you know, to be alone. And I think there's always something there that we can tell that gives a better understanding for why I was his garbage shadow. Why, even though he was going to own garbage, I was still stalking him and staring at him, you know, every time he's in the kitchen to see when he was going to take the garbage out. And that's when the fair play is about, you know, coming up with a minimum standard of care, which became garbage going out once a day. But how are you going to get there unless you understand each other? So let's just pick another one. We'll see what we get to.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, so I'm going to just keep shuffling and shuffling and shuffling until you tell me to stop.
Okay. Stop.
Okay. Pets. Tell me anything about, did you have pets growing up? Who took care of those pets? Did you not have pets growing up? Did you want pets? Do you have one now? Anything related to pets?
Oh my gosh. I have so many stories about pets. Well, where do I start? So I actually grew up, I was born in Russia in Siberia, and I didn't have any supervision. So I'm actually adopted. When I was 8, I was adopted. So the way that I felt a lot of connection because my parents were not around and I sort of raised myself was by finding stray animals and bringing them home and sort of tucking them under my covers and giving them like my milk and my bread every day until I would have 10 cats under my sheets. And I remember my mom finding them and just being so just repulsed by it. But when I was adopted, I found, you know, I was feeding a stray cat at our house. And soon my mom realized that the one stray cat turned into two stray cats that we were feeding, and I got to keep them both. So animals have been a really big part of my life. I do have two pets right now. I have Frank, who's the French bulldog, my black French bulldog, and Charles, who's my 13-year-old Pomeranian.
Yay. Is a Pomeranian a cat?
No, it's a little dog. Oh, yeah.
Where's the cat? You have to bring a cat back in your life.
I know. I don't think so. They're too stinky for me. But yeah, so pets have been, you know, Brooke and I have a section of Wags of SEI called Pets of SEI. And that sort of is the portal where people can share their furry little creatures and talk about all the love and support they've provided them through their healing with spinal cord injury, but also for self-care for the partner, you know, whether that means taking your dog out for a walk where it's just you and your dog to separate, or, you know, that animal is providing a lot of support for both you and your partner. You know, it's just sort of that connection piece where you can both snuggle with this animal and sort of like transcend this love through these animals. So that is my story about pets.
Oh my God, I'm crying. I am crying. by the way, listeners, we did not pick those cards in advance at all. They were just literally picked random. And I mean, it's unbelievable that those stories. And again, I just feel closer to you both for me getting to thank you for being so open and vulnerable to share. You have to be in a place, obviously, where people are willing to be open and vulnerable to share. So obviously you don't want to be trying this game, you know, when someone's knocking on your door because there's a leak in your sink, you know, or whatever.
Right.
You know, this is definitely something to say, like, I call it short-term reward substitution. That's an economics term where you can bring your tequila or your chocolate-covered pretzels from Trader Joe's, as I often do, and sit down with Seth for 10 minutes. And a lot of what we did before we were able to do who does what was to set our life, to plan our life by our stories. And so that's what I would encourage. Use these tools to just start telling stories. That is the boundaries is you have a permission to be unavailable. The system is understand that the ownership mindset leads to accountability and trust. And even in interabled relationships, your partner deserves the ability to have that accountability and be trusted. And then finally, though, the lifeline to all of this is your communication. And often in the what of life, especially what becomes so much more logistically challenging in the interabled world, what you're going through from, you know, my research is, you know, stopping. It's even more important to invest in communication that's not about the logistics of a very dynamic life, but, you know, sitting down to talk and tell your stories.
And I love that. And it's something that everybody can do, right? Everybody can share stories.
Everybody.
It doesn't require hand function, doesn't require legs. It doesn't require physical participation. It requires, and the thing that I really love about these cards is think about like how special you feel when you're given that 5 minutes to talk just about something about yourself. Like totally. Everybody feels special, right? And that yeah. creates a better dynamic in itself, right? Whereas like you're literally allowing that person to speak what's on their mind and tell a story about themselves and have the floor to just talk. And it's like a game. Like I think that this is really, really, really awesome.
Well, I feel like I said, I feel more deeply connected to both of you for your vulnerability and being able to share your stories. Remember that, you know, it's really not that hard to communicate if you do look at it as a practice, just like it's not that hard to get into an exercise practice if you commit to it. And often for me, it is hard because I think I'm going to be fit by exercising once, you know, it's sort of like you can't just talk once and think you're going to be communicators for life. It doesn't work that way. And so if you're saying, you know what, I want to be my best self, recognize we're already communicating. So it's a shift. It's not a start, but that we can have deeper conversations that we can, if we wait for when emotion is low and cognition is high, which doesn't always happen, right? But we can find those pockets, then we can have these types of conversations. And so that's where I think, you know, that's it. That's my gift to you, to ask you to give to me, to this community, that we will build, I believe, a such a stronger society when we all get to tell our caregiving stories. But even more important than telling them outwardly is actually to start telling them to each other.
I was going to, before we move on, Eve, can you pick a card?
Oh my gosh, sure. Okay, let's do it.
Let's hear it.
All right. Okay. I'm just going to close my eyes and pick one. Okay. Let's just go. All right. Where did I land on? Hold on. Home renovation. Okay. Let's talk about home renovation. Well, growing up, my parents were not together. And so I remember. My first experience with home renovation was our house got burglarized. And I remember one of the best things that ever happened to me was we got insurance money to put together some new home renovations for our apartment, even though it was a different landlord. They allowed us to spruce up our apartment. And so my first experience of home renovation was being able to sit on the floor. I still remember this, and pull off this sort of like peeling, gross 1970s striped brown wallpaper from our kitchen and be able to paint the kitchen a light blue with this insurance money for our apartment. So that would be my earliest home renovation story.
Oh, that is awesome. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. I mean, definitely know you a lot more now. And it's so interesting how even the three of us are doing this over a podcast and the communication is just, you can feel it level up. And so that gives me like butterflies for some, you know, couples in our community who I know are struggling with communication. And I know this may be a topic for another podcast because it can be, this is kind of a loaded question for you, Eve, but what happened? Where did that communication, that willingness to communicate with your partner go? Did we just get too stressed out? Did we just get too distracted? We have to have a communication revolution, clearly. But what happened?
Well, this is so interesting because, again, back to, I keep thinking about Rachel Yoder and this night bitch conversation I have. And we were talking about, like, do you remember, I mean, maybe Elena, not for you, because you had a different, experience in your early childhood. But I remember, you know, even with all sort of the trauma of being a latchkey kid and a single mom, I still had a lot of fire. I had fire in my life. I felt like I could change the world, that girls could do anything.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I had fire, and then the fire goes out. And so I think communication stops when the fire goes out. That's what I think. And I know that's deep it's not a practical answer. I have more practical answers again, and we could do a whole other podcast. I'd love to on communication. But it is about, I think, maintaining that fire, right? That, and you know, reminds me a lot of my son, Ben. This is why I wrote my second book, which is coming out in January. And we could do it around that. We can do the podcast around that. But it's, it was really that, you know, I'm a mediator. Like the cards, I know how to facilitate conversation. Like that's what I'm good at. What I'm not good at necessarily is talking about people's identity loss. So, you know, I when one of my first interviews, we were talking about communication and division of labor. And this woman looks at me and I say, why did your marriage end? Why did you stop communicating? And she looks at me and she said, Eve, it's because I lost my permission to be interesting. I lost my permission to be interested in my own life. I literally started crying on the spot. It was not, it was very triggering for me. It was not the level that I thought I'd be writing at. But this idea that what makes you you and how you share it with the world is very important. And if it's not paid, it's highly subversive for women. So what I will say to you, no matter where life takes you, Elena and Brooke, this community you've built, this podcast, I will call it your unicorn space. I call it that. It is the active pursuit of what makes you you. It's linked to your longevity, your health, it is your respite. It's your flow state in the middle of a stressful life. So I will say, if you're paid $1 billion for it or nothing, you should continue to do this. It's important. It's special. And it's not only inspiring because you share with the world, but it's leads to your own individual self-actualization and mental and physical health. And so I think what I would say in this loaded question is we stop communicating because I believe, as Ali Wong says in a funny way, but a sadly funny way, you know, we women wear diamonds because it's compensating for the light inside of us that has died. I think we have to bring that light back.
For sure. That's so awesome. And, you know, I remember when we first started Wags of SCI, Elena and I were in very different positions in our life, but one thing has never changed. And that is that we want to provide a different narrative than what has been provided for caregivers up until now, which is hide in the background, don't really do much with your life because it's all about the other person. And, you know, you should feel guilty if you start to make your life about you. And it's like,
yes.
You know, associating
that's not the narrative. That's not the narrative.
And it's funny because you see this transition happening, especially with like real codependency, where, you know, young women grew up with absent fathers and, you know, they have to help someone else to feel worthy and they don't believe in their own self-worth. It's such a difficult space to navigate. And just seeing that transition from like, oh, what? It's okay to spend some time with myself on myself for no other reason other than for my own mental, physical, and emotional health. What? Like that, you know, women aren't used to doing that. Like they view it almost as like it's selfish, right? And
it's
always say
irreverent. It's more than selfish. It's literally like societally not approved, right? So that, and besides guilt and shame, I mean, it's not allowed. And so that's why, again, thank you for changing this narrative. And the other thing I will say, again, even an inter-abled couple, you want your partner to be able to say to you, I am proud of you. I'm not just proud of you because you're my caretaker, right? Why am I proud of you? And I will say for men, especially, I had this really weird thing that I call permission paradox, where a lot of men said, you know, their ideal was for their wife not to work or to be in service of their household or them. But then I'd interview these men and I'd say, are you proud of your partner? And they would say, of course, she's the best mother ever. And I'd say, okay, that's a role. Tell me more about her. Oh my God, I could not do it without her. I could not have this life without her. I'm like, okay, that's a personal assistant and a caretaker. That's more roles. Tell me about her. And the men, especially that couldn't answer, there was a reporting of dissatisfaction in the marriage, which was so ironic because I was like, you were the one who told her not to do something else. What is wrong with you? And so it was this bizarre thing where if that person went on and was like, and I know, again, your partner's, Brooke started this amazing community. Elena's helping so many women, right? That passion, that proudness from your partner. I'm not saying that you need that. I'm not saying that your life has to be defined by if your partner's proud of you. But what I am saying is that piece was correlated to a lot of what women told me about their self-worth. And it's exactly as you said. It's about, at the end of the day, this is about self-worth, not defined in a role. And that's hard. And that's why this work is triggering. But that's why we're also here to help people with it.
Yeah. And you know, you talk about roles. You know, I don't know our listeners how much they know about, you know, the ego and who you create yourself to be in your life, right? Or your sense of self, your false sense of self, some, a lot of the times. But when, let's talk about change and when you try and initiate some of these changes, like the pushback that can happen, because, you know, you've trained yourself all your life in a certain way. Do you have any experience dealing with transition into allowing yourself more time for self-care and then having that little voice inside of you bite back and say, no, this isn't allowed? Now, that internal struggle that can happen for sometimes years.
Oh my God. But I'm going to tell you that it's not an internal struggle. So back to my data for interabled couples, when I would ask the question about availability, I would actually hear that the caretaker and the caregiver, I mean, the people who are in the relationship together, thought that the caregiver deserved permission to be unavailable, right? But the problem for a lot of the caregivers was the community. So it wasn't even an internal struggle. It was, of course, but a lot of it was the shame and the guilt from in-laws, from friends being like, you can't leave your partner, from schools who are calling you first, even if your partner's home. It was so strange how we've literally all conspired to keep women living like this, right? That even if you and your partner decide that, I remember when I decided to write Fair Play, which by the way, was super subversive because in 2018, everybody said, what do you mean women have unpaid labor? They're more in the workforce than men. Like you're litigating an issue of the 90s. I was like, this is important. Yeah. And we're one crisis away from labor force participation rates going and women's burnout and mental health. But no one was listening to me in 2018. And so I remember I wanted to write this. I wanted to write it up. I wanted to make it a book, even if it wasn't going to be published because people thought it was an issue that didn't matter. And I fought for it, but it meant that I needed Sundays off to write to something that may not even be published. And so I remember the guilt and shame, and I call it domestic encroachment, where literally I would take 3 hours or 4 hours and Seth would have the kids. And I was like, well, I might as well, like you said, Windex the floors first or finish the thank you notes for the baby gifts. Like it was so, so deep, this idea of this domestic encroachment. It was sort of like clouds, rain clouds that would rain on my parade. And it took me a lot of practice to say, I need to get in my flow state. I deserve this time. And often it was having to leave the physical presence of the house. In the COVID, that was harder, but now we have coffee. I love coffee shops. They're free. You can always find one. And I would write there. And then inevitably someone would ask me who's watching your kids. If I got into a conversation with somebody and, oh my God, your partner is watching your kids. Wow. Like I could never ask them to do that. Right. It was always somebody in society ready to tell me that I was making bad decisions for myself.
Isn't that interesting how strangers feel that they have so much right to have an opinion in our lives?
100%.
And we hear this quite often, even within our group. You know, one of the biggest statements we hear is, wow, good for you for staying. Wow, you're such an angel for sticking out and being the caregiver. Yeah. You know, it's very...
I can never do that, right? It's all these like bizarre, horrifically passive aggressive, like terrible things people say. As my friend... She told me this statement and then I found a greeting card that said it, right? Like when life gives you lemons, please don't tell me about the fucking cousin of yours that died of lemons, you know? It's just this very bizarre way that people have not learned to even talk about these issues because they've been so off limits for so long that even the compliments end up being couched in some sort of bizarre martyrdom or negativity.
And you know what's really interesting is that these comments that happen to women are by women themselves. And I think that is the deepest heartache, to be quite honest.
But by the way, that was my most common why I chose to write to women, which is what my mother always asked me because she's a professor of social change. And she said, why not write to men? Because this is ultimately mainly, you know, an issue of the way we perceive women in our society, even in LGBTQIA couples, those gender roles come out strong. But I said, you know, mom, it's because in my now hundreds of moleskins that I've been researching this since 2011, that I'm now writing up in 2017 and 2018. One of the number one annotations that I had, I used a lot of shorthand for patterns I saw, similar to the way sociologists will do it with qualitative research. And the most common shorthand became CIYOO. And that shorthand is complicit in your own oppression. That was it. It was women. It's why I had to write to women.
Wow. I love that. And it's a truth. It's kind of like our collective denial is very strange, right? When we come towards fighting for women's rights and equality and just to be seen and to be heard. And what a privilege to live in North America where women do have such a strong voice in their own needs. You know, there's so many different factors that are involved there, but you know, to have that privilege.
We have to use it.
That's right.
Yeah. And if we don't use our voice in the collective power, if we don't use our voice for the collective, if we don't use our power, then as Kirsten Gillibrand says, one of my favorite senators, US senators, she says the power dissipates, right? It dissipates. It tips to the power of others to make those decisions for you. And at the end of the day, you making your own decisions is incredibly powerful. Of course, we're doing it in fucked up systems. I'm not saying that. I'm also not fighting for better social safety nets for us, but we still have agency over our own life and our own decisions and our own choices. And if those are not working for you, you are a game changer in your own life. You can make decisions that are different than the ones you made yesterday. You're allowed to change your mind. And so again, I think it's about having communities of women that are really here to support you in that power.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like Eckhart Tolle always talks about how if you have something to say and you don't have a community to go to talk about it with, make your own community, right?
Yeah.
It's very true.
You did that. And again, it's why I was so happy. I'm so happy to be with you today because I think of these issues as incredibly important, and that the invisible work of caregiving can no longer be invisible anymore. It is valuable. What you're doing is valuable. We are seeing you, and we also want, obviously, for you to continue to be part of a community.
Well, thank you so much, Eve, for joining us today and sharing this incredible space with us. You've given us so much goodness, so much substance to take away with in this podcast as we continue on with our days today. And if anybody would like to connect with you, can you give us a little bit of a shout out how they can do that?
Absolutely. We answer DMs once a week at Fair Play Life Instagram and also Eve Rodsky Instagram. So you can reach us there. My assistant will send me questions. The resources we talked about, if you want to use the cards as a game to start having deeper conversations or learn about your friend's crumbling brown wallpaper, like you guys learned about to me today, you can find those at fairplaylife.com. I'm on LinkedIn. So all the places, LinkedIn is more for the political and cultural discussions, and Fair Play Life and Eve Rodsky are more for the personal solutions on Instagram.
I, for one, cannot wait to get those cards. I literally am going to take my headphones off and buy them as soon as I can.
You know what? We should do maybe a little giveaway for our listeners today. We're going to give away some of Eve's cards and her book. So stay tuned for that as well.
Yeah. Perfect. And thank you all our listeners for joining us and Eve today. We're super grateful that you tuned in. And this podcast, you know, is not just for people in anti-troubled relationships. It's for every relationship. So feel free to forward this on to people that you think would need to hear Eve's words. And it's just super important as women to share this stuff. So keep on sharing. If you need any more information, you can contact us directly at wegsofsci@gmail.com or on our website, wegsofsci.com. And thank you again, Eve Rodsky. She has a beautiful book, Fair Play, and also an upcoming book. So follow her on Instagram and make sure that you spread the word. This is really, really important stuff to talk about between women.
That's right. And together, we can keep fighting for change for women. women in the domestic workforce and at home. So let's keep that gender equality flowing. Let's keep the conversation going. And until next time, thanks for joining us. See you then.
Cheers.